Greetings. Hello. Welcome to our program today here on the 21st of April. You are watching a live stream interview, discussion, I guess, conversation with two economists on the issue of occupational licensing. I am D. Dowd Musk. I'm the VP of Research for the Southwest Public Policy Institute, a research organization that studies the eight states of what we consider the finest portion, the finest corner of America, the great American Southwest. Our topic today is occupational licensing. A new index has been released. It's called the State Occupational Licensing Index 2023. The authors are Noah Trudeau and Edward Timmons. We're going to be talking to those authors today, this afternoon. Please submit your comments, questions over social media, whatever platform you're using to access us this afternoon. And of course, our two economists are with us right now. Dr. Timmons, is a service associate professor of economics and director of the NEE Center for the Study of Occupational Regulation at the John Chambers School of Business and Economics at West Virginia University, the great fine state of West Virginia. And Noah, Dr. Trudeau, is an assistant professor of economics at St. Francis University. And we're going to jump right into the policy meat because we're all policy geeks. And just on a personal level, this is something that I've followed for many, many years. And I have a wonderful example from my home area of New England up in Boston. I hope we get to that by the end of the hour. But of course, feel free to weigh in, folks, on your platforms with your Q&A and your comments. Gentlemen, we'll start with Dr. Timmons. Tell us about this report. What this reveals about occupational licensing, the overall trend in occupational licensing, and what states are doing better and which states are doing worse. I guess we'll start with the report itself, and then we'll get into the larger issue of what occupational licensing is.
Sure. So what we saw with this issue is a real need to better understand how states stack up with respect to occupational licensing. There have been a number of reports that have been done, very fine reports, by the Institute for Justice and also the Cato Institute. What we were really striving to do was provide a comprehensive picture of what occupational looked like across the states. We took advantage of the NEE Center database. It is a database of more than 300 occupations. And we sought to count up the number of occupations that were licensed in each state, and also just the number of professions that were barred from entry in some fashion. Maybe there was another license that was preventing individuals from doing the job. And we had some priors beforehand, but ultimately what emerged was a little bit different than I think we were anticipating. Some states that oftentimes have a reputation for being rather market friendly in the American Southwest, like Texas and Oklahoma, scored quite poorly in our index. For example, Texas was licensing more states, or was licensing more occupations, excuse me, than any other state in the country. And this was a little bit surprising to us. I think, you know, Texas in particular really prides itself in being a state that is open to business, is always open to new workers. But at least with licensing, it seemed that Texas was not performing as well as its neighbors. Some other states very close to Texas, for example, like Colorado and Nevada, scored much better in our index, at least in terms of the number of professions that were licensed. So that was quite surprising to us.
Yeah, and as a resident of New Mexico for the time being, I was shocked that New Mexico did better than Texas. There's always that grass is greener argument. I was at the Texas Public Policy Foundation free market think tank a couple of years ago, sitting around at a meeting telling them how wonderful their state was, and all they were doing was complaining about medical malpractice reform in Texas. So, you know, we're human beings. We're never satisfied. Professor Trudeau, can you weigh in on this issue? I'm sure people who don't follow this issue closely, maybe a little horrified by this notion that, you know, we radical free marketeers are trying to tear down all regulation. I think probably to most people, they hear about occupational licensing, they're talking about a medical board certification. They think maybe a CPA, they may think an airline pilot flying thousands of people a day around. Those are professions that have a high degree of regulation. But boy, in recent years, that list has been, at least in decades, I guess, that list has been expanded into so many professions that people might not think of as having a high regulatory burden.
Yeah, so occupational licensing, a lot of people are surprised by the actual fact. Over the past 100 years, so in the 1920s, occupational licensing did only affect those kind of occupations that you're thinking about, or that you mentioned, you know, doctors, dentists, brain surgeons, those type of things. It was about 1 in 20 occupations were licensed. But over the past century and in recent decades, it's actually increased almost exponentially to where just about 1 in 5 occupations now has some sort of license. And while we think that, you know, there are definitely things that we want to ensure that quality or ensure that the person who's doing that job really knows what they're doing, those doctors, those bridge builders, things like that, we run into occupations where it's just overly surprising. So everything from barbers, cosmetologists, massage therapists, even one that often surprises a lot of my friends that I talk to, funeral directors, are licensed in every state except Colorado. So there are a lot of occupations that we think of as low skill or low barrier to entry, like things that like anybody can go and become, that actually have this barrier through occupational licensing.
List of the ones looking through your report, I don't understand a license for auctioneer. It would seem to me that, you know, you can tell really quickly whether an auctioneer is a good auctioneer or not. Interior decorator, which it seems to me that's just a matter of taste. Manicurist, taxidermist. You want to talk about funeral director, mortician.
Animal breeder.
Private investigator. Nursing home administrator. This is an office white collar person. They're not dealing with, you know, patients living and dying right in front of them. Very, very interesting. But also, talk about it's the broadness of this, and I'm really glad that you guys put this in the report, because it's something that I guess I could have gone and looked at the numbers myself, but the way you framed it is very, very interesting. Occupational licensing affects more than 20% of workers in the United States. In the field of regulating the economy, we talk quite a lot about unionization. I used to work for the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. All they did was sue unions. So I'm a little sensitive to union issues. We debate the minimum wage constantly in this country, but occupational licensing affects more workers than each of those regulations. Fascinating.
Yeah, so actually, occupational licensing affects more than double the amount of workers represented by unions. Occupational licensing affects, I believe I just did a presentation on this Monday, occupational licensing affects about one or double, so it's like 2.5 times as many as unions, which we think of as often a big deal. And we do discuss the minimum wage a lot, but it's actually about 20 times more people are affected by an occupational license than the federal minimum wage.
Sure. Professor Timmons, this is, we're going to get really in the weeds here. We've got so many professions that are regulated in so many states. How do you, from a methodological perspective, I mean, how do you begin to unpack something with 50 different laboratories of democracy?
Yeah, I mean, we tried to be as comprehensive as we possibly could in terms of selecting occupations for the index. It's been estimated that more than 1,000 occupations are licensed in at least one state. So we tried to be as comprehensive as we could in terms of putting together this index and getting the broadest picture of how licensing stacks up. And, you know, I think one thing that I really want to emphasize, and one important takeaway that I hope listeners get from this event, is that licensing is the strictest way that we can regulate entry into profession. It makes it a crime for an individual to do a job without meeting these minimum entry requirements that might be minimum amounts of schooling, passing exams, and paying fees to the state. There are a number of other ways that we can regulate entry into a profession, or just regulate a profession, and try to make sure that consumers get good quality service. One of those is just simply the market. If I'm looking for a restaurant, if I'm in a new city and I'm visiting and I'm looking for a new restaurant, I don't really care if the establishment is licensed or not. That's the furthest thing from my mind. And in fact, chefs and wait staff at restaurants aren't even subject to occupational licensing. Instead, what I do is I look for online reviews, I ask friends, word of mouth, and also just the market itself. If I'm providing poor quality service as a restaurateur or a chef, I'm not going to be in business for very long. The market's going to discipline me. And there's a whole host of other options that are available between the free market, which I would consider to be the least restrictive means of regulating, versus licensing, where you're making it a crime, you're making it illegal, where somebody can actually go to prison for doing a job without meeting some sort of requirements or standards as set forth by the state. And oftentimes these requirements are set forth by other competitors, which presents all kinds of challenges.
Yeah, we're definitely going to get into that in terms of sort of restricting supply and I guess rent seeking, as you economists would call it. Noah, a license, and I'm glad Professor Timmon said this, because it's not, you know, getting a license from your state government is not the good housekeeping seal of approval. It's illegal to practice your profession if you don't get it in that particular profession. Talk about the operations and the mechanics of this license process. You don't just go down to the regulatory agency and sign a piece of paper. Education, how does it manifest itself? Education requirements, tests, fees. What does a barber or a respiratory therapist or people who need to go through this process, what are the real world hoops that they have to jump through often?
Yeah, so depending on the license and depending on the state. So not only do we see variation across licenses in these requirements, but then even with simple licenses that are consistent across states, we see different requirements depending on what that state prefers to kind of set that hurdle at. So we can see everything from required degrees, specific degrees that you have to go to college for. We see that a lot with teaching, specifically elementary and high school teaching. And in Pennsylvania specifically, there's actually elementary, middle, and high school teaching, and you have to have a specific degree to go into that, or go to, if you have like a business degree and you want to teach business in high school, you have to do a fifth year certification program, kind of like a master's degree, to actually be fit for the classroom. With things, barbers, cosmetologists, respiratory therapists, we see education requirements for going to school for a certain amount of time. We see apprenticeship requirements where you have to practice as someone's apprentice, like in their profession with them, kind of supervised, and you have to have so many hours. We see exams, and sometimes upwards of 5-6 exams. The CPA exam has multiple parts. So if you want to be a certified public accountant, you have to go through multiple CPA exams. And then just, money. There's sometimes a lot of money tied up in the fees. And sometimes these are things that need to be updated every year or every 2 years. And then beyond that, once you have the license, you have to renew your license. And so that means continuing education requirements, where you have to go back to school every year for at least one additional continuing ed credit, and then additional things beyond that with the license renewal. And so we see a little bit of everything kind of across the board when it comes to these different licenses. And it really just depends on what occupation we're talking about and what state you're in.
Yeah, this has an issue that you both are concerned about, and the Archbridge Institute, which published your index, the 2023, Professor Timmons, the issue of mobility. If I'm not mistaken, there's even some folks on the left who are, I probably don't agree with them on much of anything, particularly when it comes to their issues of equity and reparations and how horrible America is. But there's a left, right, center consensus starting to congeal about the way that excessive licensure restricts people's ability to make a living and advance up into another income level.
That's right. It was about 8 years ago that the Obama White House put out a summary of everything that we know with respect to occupational licensing, about how licensing increases prices for consumers, restricts access to opportunities for individuals, and also, just in terms of, are there benefits? And, there wasn't much evidence in the report that occupational licensing creates benefits. There's some, at best, it's mixed. And in terms of mobility, licensing oftentimes can restrict individuals who are looking to move into a new state. Or if an individual is forced to move because their significant other has a new job opportunity, they might find that they're not able to work without meeting additional requirements. So individuals who are perfectly skilled and trained, that have licenses to do the job, might find that they're unable to continue working and they have to sit on the sidelines because they're forced to meet some additional entry requirements to begin working. And there's a really good research paper that was put out a couple of years ago that shows that occupational licensing restricts mobility in terms of individuals moving from one state into another by 7%.
Professor Trout, your thoughts on the mobility issue?
Yeah, the mobility issue, it's something that's actually close to home for me. So, of course, I'm a professor at St. Francis University. I just received my PhD from West Virginia last year. My significant other, Elizabeth, is a teacher by training. She moved with me to West Virginia. We're originally both from Alabama. She had an Alabama teacher certificate. As she was finishing school, she got one certification, which is technically licensure for Alabama. And she did one for Georgia because we lived kind of near the Georgia-Alabama border. And it's nice to have the options. She moved with me to West Virginia, got her West Virginia teaching license. Perfectly fine. As we moved into Pennsylvania, she found that Pennsylvania was excessively barring her entry. She was essentially going to have to go through the entire licensure process again, which means exams, which means education credits, which means hours and hours and hours of work, just to essentially prove that she can do the same job that she had been doing for half a decade at that point in multiple different states. So that restriction of mobility is a big thing. And then we also see restriction of mobility in like the economic way as well. If you put a lot of barriers to entry to these higher paying jobs, you know, the respiratory therapists, the massage therapists, even animal breeder, something that could be pretty lucrative if you were doing it well. If you put those barriers beyond just kind of entry level jobs, then people are going to have a hard time moving up economically. So we see that as well.
I just off the top of my head, the two greatest dogs I've ever owned, neither one of them was produced by a licensed animal breeder. One was in Tallinn, Connecticut, and the other was in Santa Fe County, New Mexico. So you can get good dogs from unlicensed breeders. Very, very interesting. Folks, if you've joined us late, you're listening to the Southwest Public Policy Institute. I am a vice president, I guess. Big important title. I'm in charge of our overall research architecture, and boy, are we busy here in the Southwest, because we're lucky to live in a part of the country that recently the American Legislative Exchange Council rated our region, if you average the number of our states in terms of our economic outlook, we have the best economic outlook in the country, even better than the Southeast. So we're really proud for winning that. But we have to deal with California and Nevada, California and New Mexico, which are the big challenges in our area. Weigh in on your platform, comments, questions for our economists. These are not boring economists. These are economists who know what they're doing, and they're talking about the way in which people earn a living in our country, and some of the barriers to that, and some of the barriers to advancing, and, you know, making, climbing up that socioeconomic structure. So check us out at southwestpolicy.com. We will also, of course, have this, if the folks who can't join us live, we'll have this on our YouTube channel as well. Professor Timmons, supply and demand. I can look at the face of two economists. They're getting very excited. They're being asked a question about supply and demand. It's beyond economics. It's just logic. If you are limiting the number of people entering a profession because, for whatever reasons, the lifestyle, where they live, can't meet a particular requirement, if there's excessive fees, you're limiting the number of people who are going to be able to supply that service, you know, could be cutting hair or anything else. Talk about the inflationary, whether intended or not intended, sort of the inflationary aspect of keeping people out of these professions through excessive licensing.
Sure. So, I mean, you're absolutely right, Dowd. I mean, it comes down to economics 101. If you make it harder for aspiring workers to begin working, fewer people are going to work. And research bears that out. There have been a couple of studies that have looked at how occupational licensing impacts employment. And estimates suggest that licensing might reduce employment by well over 20%. And, you know, also, just in terms of the choices that consumers have, you know, you mentioned the potential effects on the prices that consumers are paying for the goods and services that they would like to consume. If you reduce choice, you reduce competition. We would anticipate that we're going to see higher prices for those services, and we do in fact see that. You know, I mentioned that Obama White House report, and again, they summarized all the work that's been done on the effects of occupational licensing. And they find evidence consistently in almost all cases that occupational licensing results in higher prices. It might also limit innovation. You might have somebody who wants to provide a new service, like maybe giving haircuts at somebody's home or giving haircuts in a mobile salon. And the licensing law might have specific restrictions that you have to have a physical building in order to provide that service. And you know that's not meeting the needs of consumers. It's reducing innovation and reducing consumer choice.
Sure. Folks, if you want to read the study that these two brilliant economists recently produced, there's a QR code on the screen. I'm not sure if I know exactly what that means, but I think if you just scan that with your device, I don't know if I've ever done a QR code in my life, but if you scan that, it'll take it to the Archbridge Institute study that was done by these two gentlemen. Professor Trudeau, we're talking about at the core here, it's regulation. I recently wrote a book review of a new book by a far left person who is a biography of Vince McMahon, the World Wrestling Entertainment impresario who's had a lot of issues in his life, but he also created a company that makes a lot of people happy. So, you know, that might not be your taste, but clearly a lot of people enjoy that entertainment. The argument from this very ignorant author was that, well, Vince McMahon went around to various states trying to pushing these deregulation policies so that these professional wrestling matches, which are theater, you know, they're not actual sports, but they were regulated as boxing in the same way that, you know, boxing bouts were, you know, genuine competition, not scripted entertainment, which is what, I hate to break it to you folks, but that's what professional wrestling is, professional wrestling. And it was that standard lefty, you know, argument that businesses, entrepreneurs, industries are just lockstep opposed to regulation. They just reflexively support any kind of deregulation there is, because they're greedy and don't want any control by the government. I mean, you're an economist. You're a sophisticated person who understands how people actually behave in the marketplace. It seems to me occupational licensing is another example where an industry or a vested interest can use the levers and the knobs and the switches of government to really benefit them. You folks, you professionals, call it rent seeking. Talk about that. You know, that's a more. It seems counterintuitive that some businesses, some professions, might want government to come in. But we've seen this over and over again, haven't we?
Right. So this is something that's actually, it's been up in the Supreme Court recently, within the past decade, I should say, recently. So one thing that we see is that if you are already in the profession, it's great to get more regulation because generally you'll get grandfathered. So if you're already practicing, more regulation doesn't mean more regulation necessarily for you. It just stops entry of others. And that means that there's less competition for you. So something we've seen in the past decade, it's gone to the Supreme Court, was the North Carolina Dental Association. Between 2010, 2011, 2012, up to this happening, the North Carolina Dental Association actually started issuing cease and desist letters to teeth whitening companies. Everything, like these are the people you find in strip malls that just do like the teeth whitening strips for you, like over the course of an hour, and you know you walk away with whiter teeth. The Dental Association said, you know, that counts as dentistry. We are the people in charge of that. You're not allowed to do that. It also happened that four of the five members of the North Carolina Dental Board also offered teeth whitening services at their practices. And the FTC came in and said, Federal Trade Commission said, hey, you can't do that. You can't just decide that counts as being a dentist. And this ended up going to a district court, and they went to a higher court and a higher court. And ultimately, the Supreme Court said, yeah, the North Carolina Dental Association is stepping outside their bounds, trying to behave anti-competitively, is what we say. So the dentists were trying to keep the teeth whiteners out of business. And they even went as far as to issue cease and desist letters to the like product companies where you can buy these on the shelf in your pharmacy or your Walmart or your Target. So they went as far to say, you can't sell these in North Carolina. So we see that happening. It's also problematic that we see the people that sit on these boards, these licensing boards who get to approve new people to do this profession, are also people who are practicing that business. So that's the equivalent of you running a business in your town and saying when someone new wants to come in and do the same thing you're doing, you're kind of almost having a little bit of veto power, telling them, no, you can't start your business here. I'm already here, kind of thing.
Yeah, it's funny because it manifests itself in so many other areas. That I believe there was the Limousine Commission in Las Vegas, or it might have been Clark County, where you had to prove at one point, I don't know if they've reformed this yet, I got to check on it, but when I was in Nevada, you had to go to the board and prove that you would not by entering into this, offering your services, that you would not produce additional competition to the people already registered to provide limousine services. So I don't know how that's a standard that's, you know, impossible to meet. And I'm glad Professor Trudeau talked about the dental issue, because a number of years ago I wrote a study, co-authored a study on the issue of mid-level dental practitioners. This is something that the dentistry industry is dead set against. It's basically like a physician's assistant or a nurse practitioner in the dental world, where they're only allowed to do maybe a dozen different procedures, you know, fill cavities, very basic stuff, not the really heavy duty stuff. And in a place like New Mexico, where you have rural people, you have tribal governments, you have people who don't have easy access to dental services, this would really be a godsend. And the dental powers that be in state after state have been fighting this and fighting this and fighting this. We've had a couple of successes, but I happened to tweet out on our SPPI Twitter account a couple weeks ago. There was a woman for the Dental Association of Oklahoma talking about, we need more access. And I tweeted out, well, then I'm sure your organization is going to support the mid-level dental practitioners creating that as a profession. And I'm sure that little bit of snarkiness on my side about that, I probably was maybe too snarky. The issue of the boards and commissions, this is really interesting, because these are, in a sense, kind of like a quasi-governmental entity. And I've got an example from Massachusetts. I'm going to read that to you folks in a minute, but I'm going to get Professor Timmons' thoughts on that. The people who really want to control and regulate the industry and benefit themselves are in charge of enforcing the licensing scheme. Isn't that a little bit of a conflict of interest?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, licensing, at least in terms of how it's presented, is that it's meant to protect the public. It's meant to protect consumers. But the licensing boards have their own vested interest. I mean, they're thinking about, what's my competition going to look like in the future? And also, it's a possibility, and this happens in a number of instances, where members of the licensing board might own professional schools that ultimately are going to benefit from having more students completing more education and ultimately paying fees. And, essentially the state is mandating that they have a steady supply of consumers for those schools. So it's not at all clear that the licensing boards have the best interest of consumers at heart. And, going back to Noah's comment, I mean, that is exactly what the FTC has determined, that, there needs to be at least some amount of oversight, some party that doesn't have the same biases as industry participants that is overseeing the entry, in order to at least provide some degree of assurance that these industry participants are not just protecting their own wallets. They're actually looking to improve the service that consumers receive.
Great. I apologize to our viewers. I'm going to be looking away from the screen for a second, because I want to read this article, the end of this article from the Boston Globe, 2014. So not recent. This has been a problem that's been around for a while. Many state boards undercut by vacancies. Massachusetts lags badly and regulation of many groups suffers. Todd Wallach, Boston Globe, April 20th, 2014. I'm just going to read you the end, and I want to get reaction from both our economists on this. Just the last couple of graphs here. But perhaps no one is more distressed by the respiratory board's quorum problem. Basically, the problem was that many of these regulatory boards, only a couple of them would show up for every monthly meeting, and they couldn't have a quorum, they couldn't conduct their business. But perhaps no one is more distressed by the respiratory board's quorum problem than, I won't say his name, a respiratory therapist from Brockton, Mass. The board voted to suspend his license in February after he was charged with a crime, even though the board didn't have a legal quorum and hadn't heard his response yet. That's nice to be convicted before you're even allowed to mount a defense. The therapist said the charges were ultimately dismissed. So that happens often, and I would think that would probably exonerate him in front of the board. But he never got an opportunity. This respiratory therapist, 34 years old, did not have an opportunity to ask the board to reconsider its decisions right away, because the board, here we go again, kept canceling meetings and putting off votes. Quote, we've been waiting 6 months for a hearing, close quote, according to his attorney. They were meeting, getting ready to meet with the board last week. After a closed door hearing, the board agreed to at least begin the process of reinstating this respiratory therapist license, dealing with the on probation. In the meantime, the therapist has suffered financially. He has not been able to work for more than a year and has fallen behind on his mortgage, all because of an improper vote. And this is his final, this is the final quote of the piece. Quote, "You can't work without a license," close quote. Dr. Trudeau, your thoughts?
Yeah, this is a problem that's not just happening in Massachusetts. This is we recently did a piece for the Cardinal Institute of West Virginia, where we looked at some West Virginia licensing boards, where they were having similar quorum problems. You know, six members on the board, maybe not even quorum problems, maybe just getting new members on the board problems. So maybe there's six members on the board. You have to have four members to conduct business. Someone retires, someone moves out of state, someone, you know, their cycle is up. They're not allowed to sit on the board anymore. Now you have three members. You have to add at least one new person. It's difficult sometimes to add a fourth member, or, you know, if you're, I mean, you're working with four of six and you're just kind of on that border, it's difficult to fill those seats and see that happen. So a lot of states have gone to having, we're talking about this kind of third party without someone who has kind of skin in the game, have gone to public representatives, just kind of a civilian representative, or even government representatives that are coming from the state legislator or something sitting on the board to make sure that things are going correctly, or someone, you know, at least like a devil's advocate kind of position. So we've seen this across multiple states and in a lot of places, that sometimes this happens, that these boards, it's difficult to do business. We've also seen issues with these boards, the budget issues. Big West Virginia was in the news over the past couple of years that their boards had tons, millions of dollars in just savings accounts for the boards, because they bring in revenue from fees. They have some expenses, but the expenses don't always equal the revenues. And so the money just goes in an account. Maybe the board has a $200,000 budget for the year. They bring in $250,000 in revenue from new licensees. $50,000 goes in the bank account. And they do that year after year after year. And eventually they have, you know, 4 or 5 years of extra money at the end of the day that doesn't get spent on anything. And it just kind of ends up in a bank account. Nobody has access to it, and it just kind of sits there. And it isn't used to necessarily benefit that community of, you know, dietitians or anything like that. So that's one difficulty that we run into as well.
Sure, Professor Timmons, your thoughts about this Massachusetts example. I mean, it's one thing to be forced to jump through all the hoops, but it takes it to a whole nother level when you can't get a hearing with the people who are regulating you. Madness.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's indicative of a problem with occupational licensing writ large. Oftentimes, occupational licensing laws contain good moral character provisions, and that's a very vague term. So, you know, individuals that might have committed some minor crime in their past might find that they're completely ineligible to obtain an occupational license. Now, I don't think anybody wants to see somebody who's committed a crime like Bernie Madoff obtaining a CPA. I think there's a good argument there that we might not want somebody who's committed a financial crime to obtain a CPA. But if the crime is completely unrelated to the work, I see no reason why somebody who committed a financial crime can't be a barber. Those seem to be completely unrelated. Yet the law will specify that the individual has to be of good moral character, and they might be barred from getting any license whatsoever. So licensing touches the area of criminal justice reform as well, in terms of thinking about, you know, how do we get all of these folks who have made a mistake back into the labor market and contributing to society? Licensing in many instances simply blocks them from doing so.
Sure. Folks, you're watching the Southwest Public Policy Institute's live interview with two experts on this field of occupational licensing. There's a lot more to this issue than you might think of just looking at it on the surface. I'm going to go back to Professor Trudeau. And one of the ways that I enjoy listening to debates and discussions is this notion of the steel man, instead of straw manning your opponent and picking out their weakest arguments. Try to tap into their more valid criticisms, or at least superficially valid, and give a response to that. Professor Trudeau, when you debate this issue with fans of occupational licensing, do you find any of their criticisms at least have a kernel of truth, or something that maybe they don't understand the argument you're making? Just free associate for us.
I think something that a lot of people associate when we discuss occupational licensing, especially with something that criticizes it, is that we're not against occupational licensing. We're more for common sense occupational licensing. Yes, there are definitely instances in which we do want to know that somebody can do their job well before doing it. I do not want to get brain surgery from an unlicensed brain surgeon. Like, definitely awesome. Yes, lovely. We really do need some assurance of quality in some occupations. But what we're running into, and something that I at least try to express when getting extreme pushback, is I'm not pushing for no licensing anywhere. I'm just pushing for a little bit of common sense. When it comes to my funeral director, I don't think there's anything that my funeral director needs to be licensed. I don't think the state needs to verify that our funeral directors are necessarily like perfect in everything they do. Something that the market can kind of figure out. And even with certain professions, barbers, funeral directors, these are people of your community. Like, we point out, you know, the burden of the licensing, but, you know, like my father, the funeral, he's a Massachusetts man, small town Massachusetts. It was a family funeral home, 5 generations long. My dad played softball with the local funeral director. My dad played softball with his barber. These aren't just, you know, cookie cutter business people. These are people in your community. These are people that you went to school with. These are people that you know. It's not just always some amalgamous business person. And so we try to point out, like, it's not that we're totally against all occupational licensing all over. It's just, can we give it a little bit of common sense? Like, I can verify some of this quality, or if the quality is bad, it's not gonna ruin my life. So that's where we experience a lot of pushback is, oh, free market economists, you know, you want no regulation anywhere. And it's like, no, we just want a little bit of common sense.
Professor Timmons, your thoughts on the opponents.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it comes back to some confusion about licensing versus regulation. You know, I think oftentimes when you talk about, well, you know, maybe a license isn't necessary if I want to put a bouquet together or cut somebody's hair, we're not necessarily saying that we want no regulation whatsoever. There's all sorts of other ways that we can regulate that profession and make sure that consumers get good quality service. You have the market, and the market is supplemented with online reviews nowadays. You have Google reviews, you have Facebook, you have all kinds of services that can provide you information. So all that I would say is that there are a number of other ways that we can regulate professions. And even in professions where I think there is a good logical argument, as Noah suggested, that we might want to license doctors, licensing in of itself doesn't do the job. We still need board certification. We still have a variety of other market mechanisms that ultimately regulate that profession. And you mentioned dental therapists. There remains across states differences with respect to what a lot of these non-physicians and non-dentists are permitted to do. They're fully trained to do a lot of this work, but because of vested interests like doctors and dentists, they don't want or maybe they're afraid of the additional competition, or maybe it's just pride. It could be a variety of things. They don't want these other participants like nurse practitioners, like pharmacists, like dental therapists invading on their turf. And we have a serious shortage of medical professionals. There's just not enough of them, and demand for healthcare continues to grow. So something's got to give. We got to get somebody providing these services somewhere. And ultimately, I think states are going to have a hard look at, can we unlock the potential of these medical providers and make sure that folks have access to the care that they need?
Yeah, Professor, I think your comment, you began with this question of regulation via the marketplace, and I think it's something that far the average citizen, certainly people on the left, the progressive side, they just don't understand this. I wrote a column, it's the most viewed column on my Substack account, dowdmuska.com, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, arguing why I was looking at the pandemic relief, COVID relief, call it what you will, and just so much waste and fraud in that system, and just every almost daily at the city level, at the county and state level, we're just finding these appalling stories of billions and billions of dollars wasted. And my article or my column was about there are regulating mechanisms out there that impose accountability on the private sector far beyond government. And so I listed your competitors, if they do a better job, they'll be more successful. They might advertise against you talking about how wonderful they are and how terrible you are. The owners, the people who own it and own this business, whatever legal structure the business has, they want a return on their investment. Yes, government regulators exist. There's a role for regulation. Media, people in the media love a story about a customer being abused by a bad service provider or a bad manufacturer. They'll beat a path to your door. Employees, we have social media now where employees, there was a famous, I think it was last year, some woman at Walmart went over the PA system and called Walmart every name in the book, and somebody recorded it on their phone and it went viral. Employees can rat you out, and whistleblowers. And then finally, the customers themselves, if they don't like the way what they're buying from you, whether it's a good or service, they can stop going to your business or stop just patronizing, you know, whatever your service is. So there's so many more layers of other types of regulation beyond just government. So I think when Professor Timmons talks about the market as regulator, those were my specific examples of the mechanisms that regulate the private sector. None of those things apply to the government. I think that's why we have such tremendous waste, fraud in the government. But that's just my particular hobby horse. Folks, you are watching the Southwest Public Policy Institute's broadcast of the authors of a very, very important new study recently released on occupational licensing. It's called the State Occupational Licensing Index 2023. And as our time dwindles, I wanted to just throw the numbers out quickly of the 8 states in our region and then talk about some specific examples in our states. As Professor Timmons began with, I mean, Texas, this Wild West capitalist, hyper-capitalist state where things are completely out of control. Number 2 in the country in terms of the occupational licensing burden. Oklahoma, just to the north, not far behind at number 4. This is a study where you want to have a higher number rather than a lower number. California, probably not too surprising at number 11. Utah, a little surprising to be so high at 15. New Mexico, pretty much smack dab in the middle, our beloved land of enchantment, or sometimes we call it the land of scenic poverty, number 24 in the country. Arizona, 31, moving in the right direction. Nevada, one of my former places of domiciles, 41, and Colorado at 46 in terms of the where they rank on the licensing burden, occupational licensing imposed. Professor Trudeau, tell me about Texas and the electrical sign apprentice. It is the most uniquely licensed occupation in the Lone Star State. What the heck is an electrical? Is that if you're assembling an electrical sign or putting up an electrical sign, or what are we talking about? That was one of the most outrageous in your whole study.
Yeah. So what we found working through the entire index is the electrical occupations. There are a lot of occupations that you and I just would call electrician, and a lot of states like to well define that. So something that we found across all the states, when you have the option to regulate differently than everybody else, we've seen 50 different states, 51 including DC, we see 51 different ways of doing things. So electrical sign electricians or people that do the wiring for signs, what we found is that in Texas, not only are the actual electricians licensed, but also the apprentices are as well. So while you to work on becoming to get to where you can try to do the occupation, there's a license to become the apprentice to get the actual license. So it's almost 2 levels deep at that point. We see that only in Texas, that is, those apprentices are licensed. And what that runs into is, you know, now not only do you have the hurdles of getting the license. You actually have to have your apprenticeship. You have to jump a hurdle before you can even start the apprenticeship with someone. And in certain occupations, what we see is that there are kind of blanket coverages for apprentices. It's usually a legality thing. There's usually blanket coverages that when it comes to if something bad goes wrong, you know, a miswire, you blow a fuse in somebody's house or in their business and you're liable for some damages or something, that kind of falls under the person under whom you were doing the apprenticeship. And so the fault lies with them. But what we see when you have these apprenticeships licensed, that means the fault goes on to the apprentices. You are supposed to be capable at that point. So in putting that barrier, what we would expect to see is not only less electrical sign electricians, but less sign electrician apprentices. So not only have we restricted people getting into the occupation, we've restricted people training to get into the occupation. So we should see just very few across the board. And there's not going to be much growth in that because of it.
Sure. And in a state like Texas, a booming state like Texas, I'm sure electrical signs are important for all the businesses being built there. Professor Timmons, New Mexico, my state where I currently am, probably maybe for a few more years, and then passing on to Nevada or Utah or Arizona. Most uniquely licensed occupation in New Mexico is nutrition assistant, and this is in a sense it's like the apprentice. But this gets to the issue of healthcare. There are so many professions in all 50 states that are beyond, it's beyond brain surgeon. We're talking about dietitian and nutrition assistants and what was it, the elder care administrator. I mean, they're in the healthcare profession, but boy, they're hardly life and death. It seems like this is, as you said, in the healthcare, our healthcare demands in our country are really out of control. These healthcare professions you're not deciding whether to flip the switch on someone. Here in New Mexico, nutritionist assistant, for real?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to justify when you look at it, and I think it's indicative of the growth trajectory that Noah mentioned. I mean, we've gone from 1 in 20 workers being subject to licensing in the 1950s to now more than 1 in 5, and at least in terms of one report, Nevada had the highest fraction of workers subject to licensing. It was, I believe, 27%. So more than 1 in 4 workers subject to licensing. And, you know, I think, again, it comes back to, I mean, are there other ways that we can potentially regulate this particular service and make sure the consumers are getting good quality product? One alternative, and this is done in a number of different instances, is private certification. So, I mean, if I had a flat tire the other day, mechanics aren't licensed in any state. Instead, there's a system of private certification. Mechanics can obtain it. And if I want to have some information about the qualifications and credentials of the mechanic, I can check to see if they have that private certification. But I can also use other means, and it's not illegal to be a mechanic if I don't get that private certification. It's just additional information that if a mechanic chooses, they can go ahead and get it. But you know, ultimately also the market matters here a lot. I'm going to look to see what the reviews of the mechanic are. I'm going to check to see with my friends and relatives, you know, is this mechanic somebody that I can trust? I don't really care so much, what piece of paper they have from the state capitol that I happen to be in. That's not really conveying a whole lot of information. There's much better mechanisms for providing that information to consumers. And definitely in a lot of these areas of healthcare, it's not at all clear, you know, music therapists, dance therapists, art therapists, it's not at all clear that licensing is the right regulatory tool to make sure the consumers are getting good quality service. There's much less costly means of doing it.
Great. We are desperately low on time, folks, so get your comments and questions in. I'm going to kick it over to Professor Trudeau for some good news here in the Southwest, which is Arizona, just a couple of years ago, according to our economist study here, Arizona passed a comprehensive universal licensing recognition law. Noah, tell us about that and whether you think other states should follow suit.
Yeah, so universal licensing recognition, big topic right now. It's actually, I think Virginia just passed universal licensing recognition. I think Arkansas had it on the docket this year. I think Ohio had it on the docket. We're seeing a lot of states pick up on this. And this is, I would like to think, a universally good thing. That's going to be really good news for our mobility. That's going to be good news for people that already have licenses. So Arizona picked this up. They were the first state to do so in 2019. Obviously, Arizona getting a lot of in-migration, a lot of people moving out of California is what kind of the trends are showing is, you know, California real estate price is kind of high. So instead of, you know, being a plumber in California, maybe we move to Tempe and we'd be a plumber there. Maybe we move to Tucson. Maybe we just move to Arizona instead. We still get the kind of Southwest weather, but, you know, avoid the California real estate prices. So with these universal licensing recognition, what we actually see, and Dr. Timmons is working paper on this currently, it increases our chances of migration, especially for occupational licenses that they consider with like low transferability, things where the occupational qualifications between or among states are very different or very, they don't have like a national standard. So with these universal licensing recognitions, what we end up seeing is it's really easy to attract skilled workers to your state if they already have a license. So great news, you can now attract people with these high skills. They can come and work in your state and you can get more people practicing whatever their occupations are. The bad news ultimately though, it still doesn't help with new entries into these occupations. So people that are a little bit younger than myself, my generation, so a lot of my friends from high school, from undergraduate, university, they're now going into more skilled professions where they need these licenses. Having universal recognition doesn't fix that though. It only attracts people that already have licenses in other states. Now that might be good, that might be able to attract some people back home for New Mexico, for Arizona, if you have this universal licensing recognition, instead of people fleeing the state, you might see some retention or people coming back, but it doesn't help with those new licensees.
Understood. We are almost out of time. I'm going to ask Dr. Timmons, and then I'm going to go to Noah for our last comment on this. The issue of economic mobility, you know, the right and the left are at each other's throats in this country. Eileen, as a libertarian, I'm in a complicated position, but you know, the rap on America, the Elizabeth Warren, you can't make it in America. Everything's, the little guy has no chance. And you know, particularly if you're a woman or a person of color, the broader issue of mobility in our country. And there does seem to be some left-right agreement on the issue of opening up more opportunity, which will allow for economic mobility in our country. Beyond occupational licensing, what are some of the other regulations, taxes, policies, subsidies that are in place that sort of the red flag pops up where we need to do more work on providing more opportunity for young people and not giving them this crazy Marxist vision about you're going to be poverty stricken for the rest of your life? Beyond occupational licensing, what are some of the other priorities that you're looking at as a professional economist?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say, you know, one thing that we've seen governors on both sides of the aisle take a look at are college requirements for state government jobs. You know, why require individuals that are looking to do public service complete college in order to do so? And, you know, I think it all comes back to the fact that a lot of these regulations or a lot of these just tried and true standards are making it harder for a lot of individuals to get started. You know, minimum wage is another one. You know, why make it harder for individuals that might be looking for that first job to get employment? Now, all of a sudden, you're going to have them competing with folks that have more experience in education, and they're going to have a harder time getting that first start. If you're cutting off the first rung of the ladder with a lot of these regulations, it's going to be a lot harder for individuals to start the climb.
Absolutely. Professor Trudeau, your thoughts on beyond mobility, beyond licensure?
So beyond mobility, adjacent to mobility, something Ed has talked about is this idea of scope of practice, and scope of practice applying beyond just beyond the medical field as well, is what you're allowed to do with a certain amount of training. So what we run into in the medical field is with non-physician, non-dentists individuals, you know, what are they actually allowed to do? And if we restrict what people are allowed to do, sometimes that runs into a major problem. Another thing that I think about is I have a lot of friends who went into the military. They got specific training while in the military to do certain things, and those oftentimes aren't necessarily transferable into the private sector after finishing military contracts. So that's something that we run into as well, is that we have a lot of skilled professionals who are coming out of the military, moving into the private and public sector, and they're not allowed to necessarily transfer those skills based on either, you know, some sort of occupational licensing, but other regulations stopping that kind of progression as well.
Excellent. We have I'll send you gents the articles, but you might have already seen them, but I believe it was Colorado passed allowing psychologists to prescribe mental health medications, mm-hmm. Provided, you know, that they still had to go through some regulatory hoops, but not prescribing anything they want, but a limited amount of prescriptions for their patients so that more people can get, I mean, there's a mental health crisis in this country, greatly worsened by lockdown madness, ladies and gentlemen, but that's a topic for another day. And I believe the bill did not survive in Arizona, and I believe it was signed into law in Colorado. So in terms of that scope of practice, it's we're seeing, you know, here and there, you're seeing progress on that. Professor Timmons, thank you for joining us. Professor Trudeau, thank you for joining us. Professor Timmons, just let us know where people can read this. We've got a lot of interest. I've seen some people are hitting the QR code. Where can people find this? This was published by, I believe, an organization called the Archbridge Institute.
That's right. So, yeah, definitely check out the homepage for the Archbridge Institute. And, you know, also, if you're just interested in taking a look at some of the raw data, take a look at the website for the Knee Center at WVU, csorwvu.com.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for joining us today. It's great and fun to talk to people who know what they're talking about. These gentlemen certainly do on the issue of occupational licensing. Check us out, folks, southwestpolicy.com. We also have our YouTube channel. We're going to have on our website, on the updates, we'll have this video up. And consider throwing a few bucks our way. We are coming up on our one-year anniversary. Just started down here in the American Southwest. So we've got so much good policy happening in the American Southwest, but of course we do have some mistakes happening here, usually in California and New Mexico, but we're fighting to preserve the good things about our part of the country and fighting against some of the worse ideas down here in the American Southwest. And we're fighting to make your quality of life, keep it as good as it is, and even make it better in the 8 states of the great American Southwest. We will be back next Friday for a discussion, another exciting discussion on a different topic. Check us out, folks, southwestpolicy.com. We appreciate you tuning in, and we will see you all again very, very soon. Thank you.